Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Happy Milk Tooth Day! Well, actually that was yesterday, but it did actually happen. The mayor of Indianapolis proclaimed Friday, October 2nd as Milk Tooth Day in honor of the restaurant that has been getting so much attention. Chef owner Jonathan Brooks and his wife Ashley opened the restaurant a year ago in Fletcher Place. It's a breakfast and lunch spot where the menu goes way beyond typical brunch food. They call it a fine diner. But however you describe it, Milk Tooth is so far out of the ordinary that it's gotten considerable national attention. Food & Wine magazine named Brooks one of its best new chefs of 2015. Bon Appetit ranked Milk Tooth among its hot 10 new restaurants. And even Andrew Zimmern arrived there recently for a taste of Indianapolis. Earlier in the summer, in the midst of it all, the 30-year-old chef summed it up.
It's been a really busy year, but I've gotten to do so many fun things this year, aside from opening a restaurant that I never thought I'd get to do, so it's been awesome.
So it's definitely a good time these days for Chef Jonathan Brooks. But I've been exploring here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio just how the Indianapolis dining scene is doing. I've talked to so many terrific food folks recently, and I wanted to tie it all together. So that's what we have for you this week. Kind of a roundup of thoughts on Indianapolis and dining, where we've been, and where we're going. We'll start out today with Chef Steve Oakley, who has worked in Indianapolis for more than 20 years and who opened Oakley's Bistro in 2002. Where do you see food going? You know, here in Indianapolis, you know, we've had an explosion in the last couple of years of, you know, new local restaurants, you know, chef-driven kind of places. Do you see that expanding? Do you see, you know, will we reach a saturation point?
Well, I think, it's expanding now, and I think as we get some of these younger chefs and some of the older guys as well that have done different types of restaurants realize that there's a market for a lot more variety, and hopefully we see that with the chefs, so it's not just one common menu locally. You know, we have a variety of cuisines and ethnic sort of influences of Mexican seems to be the hot new flavor profile right now of putting that into your menu. People like it, they accept it. But I think it's going to grow. I think it needs to, it'll level off to at a certain point from the beer, from the wine, from the food. And hopefully it becomes more consistent throughout the whole city, and that'll help us grow as a city and as a food scene, you know.
What about fine dining as we've known it? Is that still, viable? Has, the sort of casualization of restaurant dining, played a big part in the changes that we've seen?
Well, I think fine dining, the word fine dining has kind of gone away, and now it's just become fine food, No longer do you have to wear a coat into a certain restaurant or, have white tablecloth to be considered fine dining. I think fine food has overcome the whole fine dining aspect of it needs to be done in a sterile atmosphere. Now it's more of a fun, casual atmosphere. Come as you are, enjoy the food, enjoy good wine, spirits, and so forth. So I think we've kind of jumped over that hurdle and are past it as far as fine dining goes. It's nice to see a few places that still maintain that, but I think for sustainability of a restaurant, you have to move past that and kind of be an open market to everybody.
How do you keep that focus on service, though, without that stuffiness?
Yeah, I think the staff training is the crucial part of what we do day to day. And what we tell our staff is the biggest thing is you don't want the guests to know you're there. You want their experience to be what their experience is, with their conversation at their own table. You know, obviously there's a beginning and middle and end part of a meal as far as service goes, but the service is really a point that you need to be aware of the table and understand them and just be there, but not really, you know. So that's kind of what we preach is do what you need to do and let them, if they want to interact and talk about food, then they're there for that. If not, you got to kind of read them and move on. So that's our approach to service.
Restaurateur Deb Borchelt, who now has Bee's Po' Boy in Fountain Square, also has a great perspective on how far Indianapolis has come. She was a co-founder of Basbo Pizza in 1986 and has watched the city's restaurant scene grow and sees what it still needs to do.
What do you think about the culinary culture in Indianapolis?
Well, the landscape has certainly changed since the 80s, and there's a lot more options for the people of Indianapolis. And yeah, I want to say that the people of Indianapolis have become a little bit more sophisticated than I believe they were in the 80s. Things like the Food Network, people tune into that, they get educated, and then they're looking for these either items in the grocery store, which are now available and weren't then, or they're seeking out restaurants that offer these type of products. And, of course, we have many more chef-owned restaurants than we did, or at least chef-driven restaurants than we did even in the 90s. So I think that whole culture has changed, not just because of the people in the business, the service people in the business. It's all working together to make it a better place.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's just this combination of things that has happened over the last, 25 or so years, that has kind of created this scene that we have now. But it didn't just spring up out of nothing. You know, people were pushing it forward years ago, and, people like you, and others, who were there, early on. Do you see it continuing? People wonder if we've reached a critical mass, is there room for more?
Oh, within the city of Indianapolis, there's definitely room for more. Within the cultural districts, Mass Ave might be getting a little bit crowded now. Fountain Square probably has a little bit of room left to grow. Our infrastructure is such that we don't have a lot of parking, and whereas parking did not used to be a problem in Fountain Square 4 years ago, now I feel very fortunate to have a parking lot. I think that... I forgot.
That's right. Is there still room for more growth in the yes. local restaurant scene? And people talk about needing to grow the pie, because so that we're, every restaurant's not after the same diner.
Right. Yeah, I think there's always room for growth. I mean, look at a city like New York City and how many restaurants are there and how many more are going to open up this month. Yes, a few are going to close, but some of them are decades long open, and it all has to do with how you make your customer feel and what you offer them. And I think as long as we can stay focused on good quality, good variety, good service, then we'll continue to grow and there'll always be room for good restaurants.
People have also have mentioned, the service issues, in Indianapolis. It does kind of suffer from a little bit of a perception that service can sometimes be lacking or not as attentive as we might want it or not as, whatever. Do you see that as an ongoing issue that the restaurant scene needs to address?
Yes, I absolutely do. I don't have a crystal ball and I don't know what's going to happen in the future of the city, but I can say that I have been fortunate to have some really incredible fine dining experiences. I've dined at Thomas Keller's French Laundry, Gordon Ramsay's at the London, Alinea. One thing that I can say the best meal I've ever had, hands down, was the French Laundry. But it wasn't just because of the food. It was the amazing detail to the service. And yes, we were very finely attired, but we were treated so well. And we really like to enjoy wine. And sometimes we can have a couple of bottles with a dinner. And we were so well taken care of. They perfectly matched a half bottle of white to the first four courses and a half bottle of red to the last four courses. And we walked out of there with a total of one bottle of wine between the two of us. And I've never been happier. They were not demeaning. They were not holier than thou. They were the most accommodating staff I have ever been served by. And it is a disturbing trend that I've observed recently that some service personnel think they're doing you a favor, or they think they know a lot more than you do. And that's not the way to make a customer feel comfortable and be willing and happy to pay that $50 tab before a bottle of wine. So I think more focus needs to be put onto that. I think it's really nice when you walk into a restaurant and you're greeted, and that when you're exiting that you also be given another greeting. Hope you come back. Hope you enjoyed it. And I can't say enough about that. It's called the hospitality industry, and that may be an area where we've been so focused on the culinary aspect that maybe we've lost touch with some of the hospitality aspect.
Wine and spirits expert Arthur Black of R&DC has also considered where Indianapolis has been in terms of wine as well as service. Maybe service isn't up to where we might want it to be.
In one sense, it's a lot to ask a service professional who is working at a higher quality establishment, whether it's casual or not. Like, if you're serving killer food and you're charging a premium, I don't care if the uniform is a black t-shirt. That doesn't negate the importance of knowing all of your specials, knowing all of your cocktail features, knowing your beer program, knowing your wine program. And potentially out of all those things is this world of wine. You know, I mean, the beer world is vast and the cocktail world is vast and craft spirits are getting larger. But if you do look at wine and wine producing countries and wine flavor profiles and the thousands of great varieties out there and the hundreds of appellations that over the years I've memorized and the hundreds of soil structures that sadly, yes, I've memorized, it can be a lot to ask a service professional to learn. But it doesn't matter. If you work in a restaurant that charges a premium, you should be giving high-quality wine service. If you have a list that has some esoteric wines on it, even if there's only 40 selections, find your safety zones that you can go to, or be quick to tap a wine steward or a manager in place that can come and answer questions. If you don't know your wines, you are going against the number one service mantra. You're going against this very simple, bold statement that a mentor and dear friend of mine told me a long time ago, Madeline Trufant, who's the first female master sommelier in America. It's not about you. You should only share to the extent that the guest wants to know. The server is one of the most important pieces of a restaurant. From the time that they are sat, from the time a host or hostess brings over and puts you bodies in your seats, you, for the lack of a better term, are a maitre d' for the rest of that evening to that table. Any inquiry that they have about the food, beverage program, wine list, any timing call in the way of firing courses, cleaning courses, making sure water glasses are full, all those are part of the world of multitasking that a service professional is obligated to take care of. And I think we have a lot of extremely well-intentioned service professionals that are in this community that have chosen to work at all these cool independent places with great food under great chefs. I just think we could do a little bit of a better job on increasing these sort of classical service uncompromising principles, you know.
Now, tell me a little bit about your history in serving in Indianapolis. And people a lot of times bring up something different.
you know, and I've talked to a lot of people lately who refer to the service team there as something really special. So tell me a little bit about that and maybe why it was special.
In every way, shape, or form, every service team is a family, and it has all of its craziness, and it has its quirky people, and its rock stars, and its mediocre people, and the people that should be shot. Just kidding, I'm a pacifist, not really. I actually started working in service as a valet at Peter's, and then went into doing hosting work, and then saw just how awesome the mechanics of the front of the house and the back of the house were, and you know how cool the service staff looked with their posh uniforms and you know just their discipline. I was torn between two worlds because I'm a bit of a home chef myself, and some of my friends that were back in the kitchen were like, "Yeah, man, come on, dude, come work on the line." And then I would look over and I'd see somebody counting out a couple $100 getting ready to go, you know, do shots afterwards, getting out at 11:30. I'm like, "Nah, man, you guys, you wash your mats. I'm gonna go learn how to wait tables." So I kind of cut my teeth there, and then I went to something different. And both of them were wonderful places to get started to learn. Both had slightly different philosophies to service. Both upper echelon, although something different was a slight bit more relaxed. And to your statement or inquiry, there was just every service staff, and I've been training service staff for over 15 years now. I've trained thousands of people and still do in the local community and love it. It's always been my rule of thumb that there are your A rock stars that are always going to do a good job, and they're going to make the most money, and they're always on point. And then you got the people that have good days and bad days, you know, most of us do in life. But when you clock on, you should always have a great day. That's what the guest deserves. And you have those people that, you know, they have their moments, and sometimes they'll win a contest selling wine, and sometimes they won't or miss a shift. And then you have the people that do just barely good enough of a job to where it doesn't make sense to fire them and retrain somebody. You know, you just constantly look at them like, tucking your shirt, do you have your crummer? Yes, let me tell you about this, you know, whatever. And there was a period that I experienced myself at something different where it was a few year stretch where just everybody was awesome. Everyone did their job. Everyone had their strengths, and everyone, you know, had their weaknesses, but others compensated for it, and they always stepped up. And it wasn't even like, you know, we were pulling tips or whatever. There were some of us that really embraced the beverage program and could go out there and sell and sell and sell because of our excitement and our understanding of the beverage program. And then there are other people that could carry their load and carry a weight in a lot of tables. And if they had too many people and they needed an assist from someone to go over and help, then we would. And the management staff was wonderful. You know, and then of course we had our patriarch server, Bob, you know, the unforgettable, wonderful man, who did a lot in the way of training me, anyone in the community knows and remembers. And then, of course, you know, this is the first time I was able to work for Steve. I went to him over at Oakley's. But it was a great restaurant. It really, really was. It was a wonderful experience to be a part of that team.
When it comes to looking back on Indianapolis, as well as forward, Chef Tony Hanslitz has a great vantage point. Not only was he opening chef at Peter's Restaurant in 1985, but he is currently with the Chef's Academy, and he has just launched with his wife, Rosa, the Backroom Eatery at Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market. What do you think of what's happening locally on the food scene? Has any of the changes that we've seen, you know, growing interest in local food, you know, maybe some more interest in small independent restaurants, has that influenced your decision to kind of take on this again?
I almost wonder if it's done almost the opposite. I mean, only because, you know, there are a bunch of young men and women chefing out there that are young. And, you know, actually, as we do these dinners, I started to question, Rose and I had conversations about my style of food and am I doing the right thing? And, you know, I only have four or five ingredients. It's not an encyclopedia for a dish. And I guess I just came to, that's who I am, and I can't change, and I don't really want to, and I think, you know, that's just how we cook, and that's how we eat, and that's how we live, and then we're just going to stay with what we do. I only got about 10 more years left before I get to retire, so I can't recreate myself. I can't recreate 44 years in 10 years. So,
well, I don't think you need to do that, because I think that your food is has been consistently popular. I mean, after all, you are booked up for 2 years, you know, for your weekend dinner, so there's that, you know.
Yeah, yes, but, I mean, out of respect for what other people are doing, I still want to be relevant, I think. Maybe that's what I was questioning. Am I still relevant with what's going on in food today? But fortunately, there's people that are old like me that still like to have, you know, that, like, simple, it's just simple, fresh. You can taste everything. It's not muddied up. And not that these other, the food is, it's just the way I cook. I just don't know anything else. And we went to Tinker Street 2 weeks ago, and, you know, some of the stuff this guy's doing over there just blew my mind, and in a great way. And I'm just like, how do you think of, he did a dessert with vegetable ash was a s'mores, kind of a play on a s'mores dessert. And I'm like, how do you think about ashing your vegetable scraps and putting them on a plate? I just was like, you know, wow. And it was great, and it's so impressive, but I just don't think like that. I just don't. I mean, I'm more wanting to make sure my tomatoes are right, and that I don't have to, don't burn my garlic, and, you know, so that's just me.
What do you see? Are there some changes that you can point to that you have seen, you know, since, oh, say, 1985, and now, you know, have diners changed? Has Indianapolis changed? Have you changed?
I've changed, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I remember when we first started at Peter's, you know, we laid food out, and I remember cutting triangles off the top of snow peas and, you know, fanning them out, and, you know, they went through my Tinker Toy food phase where, you know, we built it as high as you could climb, and nobody could ever carry it out to the dining room because it was going to fall over. And then to really simple, good technique. I think that's probably one of the most important things. And that may be my, you know, education background is, you know, solid techniques and solid products. I think that the diners are far more educated than they were in 1985. So they demand more, and as they should. Not that they didn't then. It's just a kind of, there's just more people that are much more knowledgeable, more farmers markets. I mean, I don't even, the only thing in 85 probably was the city market. So, yeah, so, I mean, now, you know, there's, and, you know, the foraging. I just saw something, I read an article yesterday that there's a school that's opening up to teach people how to forage. So, you know, yeah, it's changed. I mean, but the people have changed. And so we have to change with it in some ways. And for me, the change is making sure I know where my products are coming from. And those are much more available. We're going to a farm. All the chefs and instructors, we're going to a farm Friday, I think. It's this Friday. We're going to a farm, which, you know, who would ever thought of that we'd take all the culinary instructors to a farm?
Yeah. You know. So the changes are all good, mostly good?
No, I think they're all good. Change is good. It's not a bad thing. Yeah, it's good. I mean, you know, we are still have a lot of chain restaurants, and I've always felt that just because you're an independent doesn't give you a pass. You still have to be quality, have quality service, quality food, and you just can't hang your hat on the eye of independency. You still have to perform. And now there's so many good restaurants, it takes it to another level, because I've always said, like, going to Chicago, why would I want to be a small fish in a big pond? I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond that I can stay wet and I'll stay alive. I don't want to go into a shark tank. But not that this is becoming a shark tank, but, you know, there's a lot of choices now, a lot of great choices. It's fun for us because we're empty nesters, so we get to go out and eat more. So, you know, as a consumer now also, it's just great. And I get to learn, like ashes on your plate.
We've been talking about the growing Indianapolis dining scene with Chef Tony Hanslitz of the Chef's Academy and the Backroom Eatery at Nicole Taylor's Pasta and Market. Stay with us for more on the restaurant scene's past and future here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When you talk restaurants in Indianapolis, you have to talk to Chef Greg Hardesty, who got a classic introduction to the kitchen at the Glass Chimney, but who has continued to evolve throughout his career through his four restaurants, from H2O Sushi to Elements to Recess and Room 4. In the time you've been doing this, what are some of the changes maybe that you have seen?
I graduated from IU in 1991 and tried to sell vinyl siding for Sears, and that didn't work so well. Then I got licensed to sell health insurance, and I got stuck in a snowstorm at a farmer's house, and I had this big old Mercury Grand Marquis, and I got stuck in this snowstorm, and I just lost my mind, and I threw it in reverse and hit the thing, and it just, I plowed out of there somehow, and I said, I'm going to go do what I want to do. And so I got a job at the Glass Chimney. I feel like I was part of the last of a generation who got to see old classical continental cuisine, you know, tableside stuff, and just the way stuff was, you know. I think young chefs nowadays, they kind of riff on stuff, but they don't even know what they're riffing. I'm riffing on stuff that I actually saw, Chateaubriand and Tournedos and you know, all those old classic recipes. You know, it was the same menu for 30 years, and Dieter Puska was he was a great chef and a great mentor.
Oh, wait, now talk a little bit about the atmosphere, the sort of old school atmosphere that was probably prevalent in kitchens at the time.
Yeah, I think it's the beauty of the Glass Chimney experience was I had worked for a European already, so, and they definitely have the sort of brigade system where you don't talk back, you just say yes sir, you know. And working for Dieter, he was a hard guy to work for. It was never good enough. It was par for the course, because I played baseball and basketball growing up all my life and played in high school. And, you know, I was used to having coaches yell at me. You know, that was just part of the norm. And being a slow white kid, I got yelled at a lot. You know, I didn't move my feet very well, and I used to get burnt baseline a lot. So I was used to sort of getting my name called in a negative way. So the kitchen just became sort of my new sport. It was like, it's competitive, it's physical. There's teamwork, there's a leader, you know. So for me, it's being a chef has always been sort of my new athletic adventure.
So do you think that people who maybe haven't had those kinds of experiences, haven't worked in a tough kitchen, have they missed something? You know, is there some discipline that they missed? Is there, you know, learning and a sort of, I don't know, attitude adjustment maybe that they've missed?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that this generation is a little softer, a little bit more, you know, in the media right now, especially with sports, there's a lot of talk about, you know, everybody gets a trophy kind of thing. And I think that, I definitely think there's an aspect to that is missing. I know that just having been doing this for 15 years now as an owner, I came into it. I tried to be like Joachim and Dieter and Rainer Schwartz, another Austrian that I worked for. You know, I tried to be that kind of hard-ass, tough guy, and it did. It always made me feel worse than I think that I made any employee feel. So I was never comfortable with that. But I think that there is something to getting yelled at and understanding that it's only for the good of the team, you know. And I don't think that some of the younger kids can handle that anymore. And so I definitely manage, chef, own differently than I did 15 years ago.
So do you yell in the kitchen? Do you still yell? Did you ever yell?
I did yell at the beginning. I mean, if anybody wants to text Neil Brown, you could ask him about it. He's got a good classic story, as well as Eli Anderson. But I don't anymore. Like I said, it wears me out more than, you know, I wake up, and at the end of the day, I'm pretty soft-hearted, and, you know, I try to be a little bit more calm. And frankly, people just don't respond to it anymore. You know, I mean, people walk out. They'll just literally just, okay, I quit, you know. And so that's my experience, at least.
That's some of the, maybe one of the changes, one of the changes that are happening in the local food scene. You know, we have a whole different type of people in the kitchen, maybe. You know, and so maybe the kitchen culture is changing a little bit. Is that part of maybe that you've something that you've seen?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not really sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's probably a little of both. I don't necessarily, you know, like I said, I've been punched in the chest, I've been pushed, I've been shoved, I've been threatened, I've been, you know, you're going to kill me, you're going to cut certain parts of my body off and grill them, all those things. I don't necessarily think that that's the right way to do it. It didn't bother me. It just sort of competitively made me want to work a little harder. But I think that there's another way to do it, and that's sort of where we're going, and that's sort of how I've had to adapt to it. I'd like to yell a lot more, you know, I need to maintain my employees. I can't do it all myself.
Indianapolis chef Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering at the Indianapolis City Market also sees plenty of changes when it comes to restaurants, dining trends, and how chefs connect with their customers. Talk a little bit about where you see the Indianapolis dining scene going.
I'm in a good position because with the pantry is not losing money and we're doing well there, and the catering's doing really well. So I have the advantage of being able to look from the outside in and look at all my friends and other chefs that are opening these restaurants. And, yeah, you know, I think we're headed in the right direction. I think to some respect, we have to kind of drag some of the clientele with us and say, hey, it really is good. You know, you really got to go there, and you're not paying any more than you would, or as a matter of fact, you're paying less than you would if you went to so-and-so over here or Palomino or whatever. You know, try this out. So I think that the more of these sorts of things and the more of the reviews and those things, that'll drive us. Now, I will say that whatever we write about as a community is probably what's going to get followed, so we have to be careful what we write about. Because, you know, I made a comment on Facebook, and I know it probably didn't please any food writer, but it was National Cheeseburger Day the other day, and I was just like, seriously, wasn't it just National Hamburger Day like a week ago? But I think we get in the danger of cornering ourselves by talking too much about the burgers and the mac. And believe me, I sell sliders here and mac and cheese and stuff. But I think if we want to progress, and like what you were talking about, we're moving forward in it, we got to start talking about other things besides the burgers so much. Because I love burgers, don't get me wrong. I eat a burger a day if I could. But I think the serious foodies want to read about what's cool and interesting. You know, Facebook's interesting because obviously it wasn't around when I was doing these things. But Jonathan does a great job, and a lot of these chefs do a great job of putting it out there, putting their pictures of food. I do it sometimes when I can. I think that's a really, really good resource if you're a foodie to like these guys on Facebook and see what they're doing, because this is coming straight from, a lot of times nobody's even eaten that dish yet. Like, it's that dish was just made, he's still playing with it. You know, and that's
a big change that we've seen. You know, the whole the communicating directly with the customers through social media.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I think that's our marketing right now. I mean, our marketing is really word of mouth, but yeah, we do a lot through Facebook, and I find it to be more productive on the personal Facebook than the business Facebook. You know, I haven't been to Cerulean in a while, but I want to go just because of what I see Alan doing on Facebook, right? You know, it's a big deal. But I think as far as the food community goes, the bloggers and all the writers, Yeah, I think that's a I think that's a good part of it too, where we can get from the burgers to the the salt cod or whatever is being fixed. So
now, do you see,
I think chefs think that way probably more than the readers do, but I think a lot of chefs probably look at that and like, let's write about the snapper, let's not write about the burger.
Now, what are some other challenges that you think that our local food community faces in growing and getting bigger and getting more national attention?
Well, I think getting your foot in the door, and Jonathan stands a great chance at that. Along, I think Alan does, too. I haven't eaten his food in a long time now, but you can recognize it. Sometimes, this is kind of maybe a little of experience in New York. You can sit at sit in front of a plate and look at that plate and be like, this is really great, but it's probably not going to be James Beard great. But this is really great, and it looks exactly like something that would be nominated for a James Beard Award. So not that I'm right or wrong, but I look at it and something clicks sometimes. I'm just looking at a picture or looking at them. If that tastes good, that's some serious stuff right there. So I think that sort of notoriety is huge.
Chef and restaurateur Craig Baker came to Indianapolis and opened the local eatery and pub, Plow and Anchor, and Bent Rail Brewing, and sees a renaissance in local food, but sees challenges as well. How would you characterize what's happening right now locally?
We're in a renaissance right now. Like, there's, between the breweries, the distilleries, the independent restaurants, the community's really exploding. The support has been huge. I think it started with the farm-to-table movement and people getting involved with, like, the farms and seeing the effects that of keeping their money local. And then I think that there's a lot of Hoosier pride involved, and I think people are seeing that, and it's recognized by how well the beer scene has been embraced. So I think it's great. I think there's still a lot of room to go, what we have.
We haven't reached capacity? We're not oversaturated?
I don't think so. I think that the thing that's going to limit us is staff and talent and, being able to get people trained into the industries quick enough and in all those sectors. In the beer community, you have a lot of people who start out as home brewers and then transition into production, and that's difficult. It would be best, I think, if the culinary schools can keep up and we can get more people to move from surrounding cities. With the influx from Chicago and people coming down, I think people are also realizing that they can open a restaurant here for about half of what it probably cost in Chicago. And I think some of the, not to pick on celebrity chef Michael Simon, but he caught on pretty quick. So, I think we're getting national attention, and I think it's good. Brooks is pulling in all kinds of stuff. I think it's only going to get better as people start to recognize that, what's going on. And because mainly I don't think people outside of Indiana know that what's happening here.
So we're sort of an untapped market nationally. They just, the attention hasn't landed here yet, but maybe it is, right? Maybe it's starting to.
Yeah, I think it's getting there. I mean, with all the guys that cooked at the Beard House and other things that people are doing, their national focus, I think it's good to see that, one, I'm speaking from myself, my personal experience, the some of these national people are embracing what we're doing here, as far as like a style of cuisine. I kind of feel like we're separating ourselves consistently now from Chicago and Louisville, and I had someone, a judge, say to me, who's a Beard person, she was like, the moment I put it in my mouth, I knew it was you, that you were from Indiana. And so, like...
Well, now that's kind of nice, I think, right?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going for, right? It's like, how do I get this across in a way? We were supposed to... the International Farm to Table Conference, and we were trying to reference our point of view on food in that region. So I thought it was the biggest compliment I could have. I didn't win, but it was still like the biggest compliment I could have. And I think that those experiences, as we grow, more and more that's going to happen.
Looking back at the local food community and what's going on, what do you think we need to do better?
That's an interesting question. We have definitely reached a point where economically it's getting difficult for restaurants to support local farms because the retail demand is outstripping our supply.
So they can sell at retail at the farmer's market to consumers, right? And make more money that way.
Right. And then what happens is then the wholesale prices end up coming up, and then it gets difficult for us to buy at a price that we can turn around and sell in good conscience, sell it to a customer. And because of the increased restaurants, the demand on labor is up. So because of that, we have increased wages. So it is like restricting the growth in that area and in our community.
And it's not just the restaurant scene that's growing. The beverage community in Indianapolis is expanding as well. Beverage professional Charlie Shoemaker is general manager at Sangrita Saloon and active in the local chapter of the United States Bartenders Guild, and sees huge growth in Indianapolis. Let's talk cocktail culture in Indianapolis.
Really, the culture is about the community and bringing the beverage community together. And, you know, over the last 4 years, that's really taken off in Indy. You know, it's not as splintered as it was. You know, everybody's collaborating. We've got the USBG chapter now, so we're all going to meetings together. We're visiting each other's establishments. We really know everybody, you know, more so. Like, we all know each other, and we hang out together, and we visit each other and bounce ideas off of each other. So it's really that cocktail culture coming together as a community, as a whole. You know, it doesn't necessarily be a trend or anything, you know, because those are how trends develop, as a bunch of people getting together and having some ideas and really kind of getting those out there.
Now, you mentioned the USBG, that's the United States Bartenders Guild. So we have a very active Indianapolis chapter that's just launched in the last few years. And so, like you said, that is part of what's building. Right.
Yeah, it's been huge. You know, with the chapter, it's grown leaps and bounds compared to a lot of other chapters and that. You know, so we're getting bartenders in competitions. We're going to Tales of the Cocktail as a chapter. We're going to Portland Cocktail Week as a chapter. You know, really everybody is doing a lot of these things together. Paris of the Plains, Kansas City is going to be coming up. So, you know, there's a lot more of that. So that chapter has been, you know, huge in that, and getting people together and getting everybody involved. You know, we've met more people that way, I think. And it's really good at fostering, you know, younger bartenders and people who are just getting into it. And now they've got a wealth of knowledge and people to work with and really develop their, you know, their professional career.
And you have, the organization have brought in speakers, you know, so we've had some very big names, you know, to come through town in the last couple of years. So that's been kind of encouraging too.
Yeah, we've had, I mean, huge names come through. David Wondrich, Dale DeGroff, Angus Winchester, these huge, huge names coming in and presenting the chapter. And, you know, we're getting these brand ambassadors, we're getting the distillers, we're getting the people who are into, you know, work with this product, make this product. They're coming in and speaking to us, and we're learning more about it. And so, you know, really beneficial. And it gives us a story, and we understand them a little bit better, and they understand us a little bit better.
Now, how do you think that this, that our current situation kind of developed? You know, can you pin it down? You know, so Ball and Biscuit opened 5 years ago in June. Libertine opened in its first location the next year in 2011. So the last 4 or 5 years have seen some, you know, of the serious cocktail bars opening. Esquire started noticing, you know, so they've been listed, both of those places have been listed in the best bars in America. Is that when it all started to start rolling, maybe?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, those first couple of places that really, you know, with Bomb Biscuit, Libertine, that really were like, okay, we're going to embrace the culture, the cocktail, you know, the things that are trending that in other parts of the country and really getting back into that, they started to embrace it. And then, you know, it's one of those things as soon as, you know, you've got this, it's kind of like a spiral effect. So you've had, you know, bartenders who all started opening these places, you know, at Balm Biscuit or at Libertine, you know, the first two real, like two places that were doing like that, you know, serious cocktails, what I like to call it. Doesn't have to be crowded. It's a serious cocktail. They take some time and, you know, they mean there's a lot of heart, energy and effort put into it. Now they've, you know, they've kind of gone off and, you know, they've opened their own bars. They're doing their own beverage programs. They're, you know, so it's kind of that, it kind of starts there and it just kind of gets out there and people start spreading out and then they're teaching other people. And it's really a, you know, it's kind of a snowball effect. It really gets rolling and,
it really does because, you know, you've seen, you know, some of the, you might, I don't know, say alumni of some of these bars, you know, like you said, go out, you know, and open their own bars or their own businesses. You know, right. We have, you know, Wilkes and Wilson that kind of evolved from that, right. You know, the elixirs and that sort of thing that they're doing. You know, we've seen bartenders, you know, leave a place and open their own places, you know, like Joshua Gonzalez with Thunderbird, for example. And so I think you're right. I think we're seeing a ripple effect, you know, from those first serious cocktail bars.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely gotten that way. It's really neat to watch. And yeah, everybody's doing things. I mean, businesses are evolving out of, you know, Wilson evolved out of, they were making their syrups and, you know, people were liking them and it was like, hey, this could be a business, you know, because other bars are wanting them. And, you know, they were able to start an entire business with it and they're doing awesome and they're making great stuff. But yeah, and then people are going out, they're opening, you know, opening their own places or they're controlling their own beverage program. You know, so it's really neat. I mean, it's been huge, huge growth.
So what does the future hold for Indianapolis dining? Chef and restaurateur Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar talks about dining trends, where food is going, and whether Indianapolis can compete.
Somehow the pinnacle of dining globally now is this modernist sort of style of dining. I mean, you know, the top 50 restaurants in the world are dominated by you know, people who are doing modernist cuisine, you know, Rene Redzepi, Massimo Bottura, Grant Achatz, certainly now, Curtis Duffy. That has become, that style of food has become the pinnacle of dining. So it's almost like if that's what you're trying to achieve, then that is the kind of food that you have to do. The reason being, of course, is that every plate has 15 touches on the plate. Everything has to be executed at amazingly precise sort of levels. It's not for me. It's not what I wish fine dining was. The common sort of thread, of course, is the level of service. That's what ties all really truly great restaurants together is amazing service and guiding someone through a dining experience. It's not for me. It's not my thing. But it's you know, you have to have teams and teams and teams of people executing this food for people. And it's an immense amount of organizational structure. It's an immense amount of work and oversight. And it's incredible in that sense.
Do you think, in Indianapolis, you know, that the future of dining is going that way? Or is the future of dining going another way?
Well, I think it will go that way, depending on the way that fine dining goes globally. If modernist cuisine isn't something that sort of sets the bar anymore. You know, I look at, like, you know, you look at restaurants owned by people like, certainly like, you know, Gordon Ramsay, who has, you know, guy has more Michelin stars than any chef in the history of Michelin, right? He doesn't have any modernist cuisine restaurants. Daniel Boulud doesn't have any modernist cuisine restaurants. There are elements of modernist cuisine in each of their restaurants. You look at sort of proteges of, like, Daniel Boulud, like Gavin Kaysen, who moved to Minneapolis and opened his own place. That's not modernist cuisine. And he certainly has, you know, the guy has, you know, been captain of Côte d'Or, and the guy is acclaimed. I mean, he's certainly qualified. If modernist cuisine continues to be the benchmark for great restaurants, I'm not sure Indianapolis necessarily will embrace that and therefore will be perceived as being left behind. If the benchmark for the greatest restaurants in the world comes down to hospitality, then we certainly have as good a chance as anybody else.
You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Thanks for tuning in this week, and thanks to the terrific lineup of people who contributed to today's look at Indianapolis dining. Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, Stephen Oakley of Oakley's Bistro, Deb Borschelt of Bee's Po' Boy, Arthur Black of R&DC, Tony Hanslitz of the Chef's Academy and the Backroom Eatery, Greg Hardesty of Recess and Room 4, Craig Baker of The Local, Plow and Anchor and Bent Rail Brewery, Brad Gates of The Pantry and Gates Catering, Charlie Shoemaker of Sangrita Saloon, and Neil Brown of Pizzology and the Libertine Liquor Bar. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio.